I was doing the dishes this week and my daughter came up to me and said, "Mom, is Monica Lewinsky good or bad?" That's a great question. Is there such a thing as being a person who is completely good, who is flawless, who is impeccable? Or are we people that are flawed? Are we people who are morally broken?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
A point that we've made over and over again throughout this section on sanctification is that we are not people who are blameless. We are not people who are completely righteous. We are people who are, even as believers, still very much sinners. In fact, a way you've described that many times, Jack, is that we are morally bankrupt. And yet there are many passages throughout Scripture that say, that look like they say the opposite of that. That we, once we are believers, once we are saved, that we are new creatures, that we are new people, that we are righteous and blameless before God. I think it would be important to spend at least one program talking about some passages that seem to contradict the assertions that we've been making about our moral bankruptcy in spite of the fact that we're saved and being sanctified.
Okay, sounds good.
There was a passage that you were talking about going to, so let's do that right now. Luke 1:6. If I can read that, it says, "And they were both righteous in the sight of God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and requirements of the Lord."
That's where Luke is describing the birth of John the Baptist, and he's describing, that's a description of his parents, Elizabeth and, Zechariah, that Zacharias was a priest, and his wife Elizabeth were both described as being righteous and blameless in all the commandments and requirements of the Lord. Both of those terms, righteous and blameless, we need to talk about those. Those concepts are crucial concepts, because the question is this: does righteous mean good, or does righteous mean a person of integrity? To speak roughly, I mean, the point is, but if it means that they are good in the sense of morally flawless, morally perfect, morally without any moral failures in my life, then that's one thing. You know, for them to be righteous means they're just utterly good people through and through. There is no evil in them whatsoever, and there you go. And that would be a contradiction to everything that I'm saying. On the other hand, would it make sense to call a person who's a morally flawed person, who's fundamentally evil, fundamentally morally bankrupt, as I've been describing, but who stands out among all the morally bankrupt people in the world because it's a person who's made some fundamental personal commitments to integrity and to a set of moral values that are consistent with the character of God and the eventual kingdom of God. What I would argue is that the way that the term righteous gets used often, not always, that there's an ambiguity in the term, but most generally the way the term righteous gets used is to distinguish a certain class of evil people, a certain class of morally bankrupt people, namely that class of bankrupt people that by the grace of God has come to march to the beat of a different drum, in that they have been captivated by this vision of a way of living that is full, that is ruled by goodness and love and mercy and truth and justice and and on and on and on, the values of God and His kingdom. Because their character has really been formed by a commitment to those values, they are righteous in a way that other morally corrupt people are not righteous. Other people not only pursue evil, but they pursue it with a vengeance, they pursue it shamelessly, they pursue it with impunity, they applaud other people who pursue evil, that their whole attitude toward evil is fundamentally different. They don't see their evil as some kind of failure, they see their evil as something to glory in and pride themselves in and rejoice in. The righteous person may fail morally, but they don't rejoice in that. They find it a source of sorrow and grief, and it's the thing that makes them cry out to God, God have mercy on me, God save me, rescue me.
I'm thinking, Jack, of the word that you used in evil, and I think that could be, although I think in many ways it's very accurate, I think that in our way of understanding that generally in our culture, that may not be as understandable here. So let me help out a little bit by way of example. I was talking to somebody actually yesterday, and this person said that they've been in a situation where they have been very, very, very wronged and very hurt in many ways. Essentially betrayed. I'm thinking of the situation, and I really can't give the details, and I'm trying to be as specific as I can when I can't be specific. So that's kind of a difficult task. Anyway, I just, if you'll believe me, this person has been incredibly hurt and has and just very wronged. And so the people around them are telling this person, you should not forgive your spouse who has betrayed you so heinously in this way. There is no place for forgiveness. There is no place for any kind of even talking to this person. You need to just hate this person because they have done so much wrong to you. And that, I would say, is an evil counsel to this person.
Yes.
It's wrong because there is a difference between continuing to allow yourself to be betrayed and put in a very, very hurtful position. On the other hand, it is a good thing to want to forgive that person, to want to not hurt them back and to allow justice to come from God. But to want good for that person is a good thing. So the one that wants, the person that I was talking to, wants to forgive, and yet it's getting given this counsel, don't forgive. So I think that those two things are juxtaposed to each other. I think one person is righteous in that this person that I was talking to certainly does fail and yet wants to pursue a life of forgiveness. The other people don't even care. They're saying, go for it with abandon. Don't forgive. If there's any possibility of hurting back, then do it.
Yes, that's exactly the distinction that I'm making. And the point being, the one who has an impulse to be merciful would make no pretense about being a thoroughly good person. That, right? I mean, that.
Oh, absolutely. This person would say, I'm not. Right. Did I make errors too.
And in fact, as we've talked in the past, that's one of the foundations for showing mercy is my own recognition of how much like the person that's hurt me I am. How capable I am of doing the same sorts of things that have been done to me.
Or maybe not exactly the same stuff. Like,
right.
I might not go rape somebody, but I may in my heart have, you know, incredible covetousness or selfishness. So I might not have the same weaknesses in the same areas. Nonetheless, I am still as weak.
Just as unworthy, yeah. Exactly. So that's exactly the distinction that I'm making. And the New Testament does not hesitate to call a person who has this incredible impulse to be merciful, as God would be merciful, to call such a person righteous. But in calling them and designating them righteous, it's not in any way implying that they somehow have transcended sinfulness so much, so thoroughly, that you won't find sin in them anymore.
They are, in essence, and this is, I've said this a few times perhaps here, is they are a David. King David. He was a person who did a lot of things that were horrible. He failed all the time. And yet, God called him a righteous man.
Right. Exactly.
And he was a righteous man in the sense that he didn't like what he did wrong, and he wanted to pursue what was good, and he really struggled with it.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, so we've got our definition of righteous. What about blameless?
Okay, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and requirements of the Lord. Okay, well, let's look at this in the context of Elizabeth and Zacharias' life. They were Jews who would have been keeping the Mosaic Covenant as that covenant had been kept in their time. Well, what did the Mosaic Covenant involve? The Mosaic Covenant involved guilt offerings, sin offerings, offering at the Day of Atonement for the sins of the entire nation, and so on. That is, part of what it means to keep the commandments and requirements of that covenant is an ongoing, daily, continual acknowledgement that I have sinned and I need your mercy, God, because of my failures. So how does one walk blamelessly in the commandments and requirements of the law? Well, not only do they take those positive values that are embodied in the law, love your neighbor, do justice, be merciful, be pure, the various ways that the law captures those values, not only do they take those seriously and pursue those as values to govern their lives, but to the extent that they are constantly failing in those regards, they take the need for God's mercy seriously and practice their religion in a way that honors their need for mercy, that acknowledges their need for mercy by taking the appropriate sacrifices at the appropriate time to the priest of the temple. So my point is, you can walk blamelessly in the commandments and requirements of the Lord without being an unflawed person, a morally unflawed person.
Well, it seems like in order to go ahead and make these offerings, you have to recognize that you are indeed a flawed person.
Exactly.
Or you wouldn't be making the sacrifices in the first place.
Exactly.
So it's coming out of a different heart, not one that I'm all fine, but one that humbly recognizes my sinfulness and my need, at that time in the Jewish culture and under that law, I need to make these kinds of guilt offerings, sin offerings, and to the Lord because I am guilty.
Exactly.
And that's what they would have called blameless at the time?
Yes, I think so. Take, for example, all the prophets who talk about that Israel, when they were offering up their daily sacrifices and so on, and God, through the prophet, says to them, the smoke from the burnt offerings is stench in my nostrils. What I want is a broken and contrite heart. Many, many passages that are roughly to that effect. Well, what is he saying? What he's saying is, yes, you're going through the motions. You're offering up these animals on the altar and on the sacrifices, but they are of no significance to me. I don't want burnt animal flesh. That's not why I instituted these religious rituals. What I want is for the offering that you are offering as a burnt offering to me, what I want is for that to be meaningful. What I want is for
that to
you
represent,
to acknowledge that you need my mercy and that this is a request for mercy from me.
So it's like a picture. He wants the burnt offerings to be a picture of a heart that is broken and contrite.
Exactly. And if it's not filled with that content, then God says it becomes meaningless. It just becomes an empty ritual, a ritual without any value whatsoever. So what's the difference between a person walking blamelessly in the commandments and requirements of the Lord and one who's not? Both of them may keep many of the requirements, but one of them is doing so out of a heart that loves God and wants to serve Him and wants to honor Him and wants to show gratitude to Him. The other one is doing the same sorts of things out of just kind of a dutiful, perfunctory, religious impulse that has no content to it, because there's no real love of God and no real desire to serve Him.
Well, let me give an example of what I think you're saying. I was having a discussion with one of my children and telling my child that obviously they were wrong about something that they had done. And what they said was, okay, I'm sorry. Well, that was very perfunctory. It was like, I think, in other words, if you translate that, it was, okay, Mom, get off my back. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to have to deal with it, so leave me alone. I'll just say what maybe you want me to hear, what maybe you want to hear. Well, I really didn't want to hear that because it had nothing to do with understanding the content of what I was saying, and they didn't get out of it because if they were to say, I'm sorry, I really wanted it to come out of their heart. I contrast that to something that I did. Yesterday, I woke up on the wrong side of the bed, and I was really a grouch, and kind of grouching around and getting mad at everybody for not having the counter wiped off quite right, or, you know, the kind of stuff that I'm sure you never do, right? But just, you know, just generally being grouchy. And later in the day, I was thinking about it, and I went back to each of my children and said that I was really wrong, that I felt bad about getting on them in the way that I did, and truly felt badly about it. So that's what you're talking about. I can say I'm sorry, and they're both the same words, but one of them's coming out of a heart that really does feel humbled, feel like it has done wrong. And the other is just, let me just get out of this. Let me just do the minimum so I can go off and do my own thing.
Yeah, that's precisely excellent examples. And so translate that into our relationship with God and into the religion of Israel, and both people take an offering to the temple, but one of them is doing so from the heart, the other one is doing so from habit of religious practice. And it makes all the difference in the world. The first is blameless. The one who's doing it from the heart is walking blamelessly according to the commandments and statutes of the law. The other one is not.
I just have to say, though, that that's a very misleading word then. It blameless to us really sounds like perfect. I have done absolutely nothing wrong.
Well, it does in our idiom. I think that's true. But you know, put it in the context of the entire gospel story, and I think it begins to make sense, because the issue in the gospel is God going to hold anything against me or not? That is God going to make me suffer the just penalty for my sinfulness and my unrighteousness and my moral unworthiness, or is he going to let it go? And to be blameless is to let it go, is to not hold me accountable for the blame that I have. So the whole concept of justification, the whole concept of being justified in God's eyes, that is so prominent a part of the book of Romans, for example, it's really quite clear that justification is correlated with forgiveness, not with goodness, not with moral worthiness, but with God's forgiveness of my moral unworthiness. So we are justified, we are righteous in God's eyes, and yet it's not because we have demonstrated our moral worth. It's because God, in his mercy and his grace, has decided to not hold my moral unworth against me, and therefore I stand justified. Well, blameless is being used in a very similar, analogous kind of way. It's not that we're blameless in the sense that there is nothing to find that we are blameworthy for. Rather, it's that there is nothing that we are blameworthy for that God is going to hold against me. That's the sense of blameless that, in the way that he's using it, I think.
Okay, Jack, well, let's go on to some more passages. You, being a teacher, I think probably would be very familiar with the standards for leaders. And there's some pretty high standards for leaders, particularly for pastors.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the passages is 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 13. Let's go there.
Okay, he mentions things there like being above reproach, being the husband of one wife, being temperate, prudent, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not addicted to wine or pugnacious, gentle, uncontentious, free from the love of money, and so on.
Pretty high standards.
Yes, they are, but they're not impossible for even morally unworthy, broken sinners. In that, if, you see, it depends on how we understand this. Do we understand this to mean being free from the love of money in the sense that I don't even struggle with the issue, that I don't even feel the impulse to greed and acquisitiveness and materialism and so on? Do I not even, am I totally untouched by those? if that's what he's requiring, that standard is so high that nobody would qualify, it seems to me. And I just have to appeal to the listeners, look at your own heart. Is there anything about materialism that's attractive? Anything about greed that touches you? Anything about acquiring more and more toys and possessions that is all interesting to you? If anybody can say no, I'd like to meet them. I think they're superhuman. I just don't think they are in a class with the rest of us. And if I'm based on what the Bible says, I would have to say that if anyone says no, they're lying, that they don't know themselves very well, that they've deluded themselves, because the human heart just is vulnerable to things like greed and acquisitiveness and materialism. We just do have an impulse to be fighters, to be pugnacious, to want to beat up on people who've hurt me.
Is that what pugnacious means?
Yeah, it means to be feisty, to be...
ornery?
Yeah, when it comes from actually literally having a fist fight, I think, wanting to punch somebody's lights out.
Hmm.
Uncontentious. Don't we all have an impulse to want to get people on my side against the people who are criticizing me or who are against me in any sense whatsoever? Don't I want to enter into a warfare with them, a fight with them, and win?
Don't I want to be right?
Don't I want to be right, exactly.
Being right, even if I don't have a fist fight at all, I just might have a verbal superiority where I can end up being on top.
Right. So if we are invulnerable to all the temptations to these things, then I don't think anybody would be qualified. But I think rather what Paul is saying here in 1 Timothy is, are we the kind of people who have become wise enough, enlightened enough, that we have embraced as values to guide our lives by, I shouldn't be contentious, I shouldn't be pugnacious, I shouldn't be ruled by the love of money, I shouldn't be a slave of money. And we are so committed to those in principle that as far as it is possible within us, we rule our lives by these other values that are so different from the values that just naturally and instinctively drive other human beings. And so I resist them. I resist the impulses to the temptations to these things. Now, will I be unfailing in my pursuit of those values? I don't think there's anything here that would suggest that I would be unfailing in that regard. But I would have such a substantial commitment to this value system as the value system that I live my life by, that it will make a dramatic difference in how I behave and what attitudes I take toward life and what choices I make and what judgments I make and so on. And those people who have that substantial commitment to this value system are qualified to lead others, are qualified to oversee the lives of other people.
Okay, well, let me give you a but.
Okay.
I think what you're doing is appealing to our everyday walk of life. You're saying, come on, you guys, if you really look at your lives, certainly you're not going to be above reproach in any of these areas. You might have a very strong commitment and value these things, and your life will then probably fall in line better with these things. But come on, you guys, if you really look at your hearts, you do fail in these areas. Now, that certainly makes sense to me. As I look at my own heart, even though I want a lot of these things, I certainly fail. And as I look at many, many other people's lives that I've had the opportunity to see in very close, certainly deacons, certainly pastors, certainly leaders, spiritual leaders in our communities, I have seen people wanting to do well and yet failing tremendously. So, yeah, from looking at life, that's true. But in this scripture, Jack, I don't see him saying that. It looks like he's being a lot more black and white. He's saying, as an overseer, you must be above reproach. And then up in verse 8, it says, deacons likewise must be men of dignity, not double-tongued. Women must likewise be dignified, not malicious gossips. It sounds like he's saying that this is a black and white, you must be this way kind of person. So how, from the scripture, can you argue it?
Okay. Well, we have to get a little bit sophisticated here in our interpretive method, I think. And that is, Paul, in a passage like this one that we're looking at, 1 Timothy 3, Paul is only addressing the questions that he's addressing from the perspective from which he's addressing it. He doesn't have my questions and my controversies in mind as he pens this. So,
he has his ideas in mind about where he's going.
Yeah, and what it is he wants to communicate and to whom and why. So we can bring our questions to the text and our controversies to the text, namely this controversy that we're addressing. Mm-hmm. Are we fundamentally broken people or are we not fundamentally broken people? And if Paul doesn't have that controversy anywhere in his thinking as he writes this, then his words are going to be ambiguous with respect to the answer to that question. Do you follow what I'm saying? That he's not trying to be clear about that if he doesn't have answering that question in mind. And it's going to be a real happy accident if he happens to say something to make it clear where he stands on that question, because since that question is not in view, he's just laying out a whole different agenda.
So what is his agenda here?
Well, I think his agenda is simply to say, well, let me back up. I mean, let me answer that in a second. So given that a text like this would be ambiguous with respect to the controversy that we're discussing, one could look at it as in one way or another way, and depending upon what answer you give to the question, are we fundamentally broken people, we're going to read it one way if we think the answer is to that is not in Jesus, we're not. Jesus fixes us and we're not broken any longer. If Paul agrees with that assessment, then we need to take all of his language here in one way. Namely, above reproach means literally flawless. If that's the background, if that's Paul's assumption when he writes this, then that's probably what he means. That's most likely what he means. If, on the other hand, Paul's own assumption when he writes this is, well, of course we're not completely, have not completely transcended our sinfulness, because everybody knows that we haven't done that. If that's his assumption, then it means an entirely different thing. So how do we decide what Paul in 1 Timothy 3 means? We have to read 1 Timothy 3 in the context of the rest of everything else that Paul says. What does he teach in Romans? What does he teach in Galatians? What does he teach in Colossians? What does he teach everything else when he's not talking about the qualifications for elders, but when he's approaching more directly my fundamental moral standing as a creature being justified by the grace of God? Well, that's a big question, but my contention would be, when I turn to books like Romans and Galatians, that it becomes really very clear. I don't think I can make any sense out of his arguments in those two books if Paul is not saying those of us who are of flesh sold into bondage to sin, a phrase he uses in Romans chapter 7, that he means our basic fundamental moral character is as people of flesh sold into bondage to sin, who can be justified in God's eyes by their faith. Well, that, I would argue, is his underlying assumption. That's something that he just is so foundational to him and so fundamental to him that sometimes he's not even going to talk about it, he's just going to assume it. And that's what I would argue is going on in chapter 3 of 1 Timothy. He never talks about that. He never says that explicitly in 1 Timothy 3, but it's the underlying assumption behind everything that he's saying. That, of course, we are of flesh sold into bondage to sin, but there's two kinds of people who are of flesh sold into bondage to sin: righteous people and sinners. And in order to be an overseer, we need to be not only righteous, but we need to be mature in that righteousness. We need to be above reproach. We need to be we need to have such maturity that we are not addicted to much wine, for example. Could somebody be addicted to much wine and be a saint and be a believer? I think so. That they just have not reached the kind of maturity that they've been able to allow the principles and values of God's kingdom to so come to bear on their life that they have become freed from their
addiction.
Yeah, I think so. That doesn't rule them out as a child of God, but Paul says it does rule them out as someone to lead others because they don't have the kind of maturity yet that has really made given substance to their character and the integrity of their value system. So he's talking about a high standard in any case. I mean, he's talking about what I would call maturity. These are people that not only have made the commitments that believers are committed to the value system that believers are committed to, but they have a very substantial, mature, well-developed commitment to those things.
Okay, well said. Well said. Can we turn to another passage?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm thinking of the passage in Titus 1:6-9.
Starting with 5, it says, "For this reason I left you in Crete," speaking to Titus, Paul speaking to Titus, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you might set in order what remains, and appoint elders in every city as I directed you, namely, if any man be above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. For the overseer must be above reproach as God's steward, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not addicted to wine, not pugnacious, not fond of sordid gain, but hospitable, loving what is good, sensible, just, devout, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word which is in accordance with the teaching, that he may be able both to exhort in sound doctrine and to refute those who contradict."
So there's a whole lot of overlap in these two passages.
Yeah, right. It's basically the same. He's setting out the same standard. He omits some and includes some others that weren't in the First Timothy passage. But I'd say basically the same thing. Yes, he thinks that the overseers should be very mature and experienced in their commitment to the value system of God's kingdom. And maybe even beyond that, not just mature, but, I mean, I don't know what to do, frankly. I just haven't looked at this enough to have an opinion about having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. What's that all about? I mean, especially in view of the fact that every individual human creature ultimately goes their own way and makes their own choice and the freedom that God has given them. It's not obviously and clearly a reflection on my maturity, what my children decide to do. Given that seems, on the surface at least, problematic to me. One possible answer is that Paul is not saying that someone whose children who are in rebellion is not mature enough to be an overseer, but what he might be saying is someone whose children are in rebellion may unfortunately be in a position that they cannot be publicly perceived as being capable of spiritual leadership. And therefore,
I'm thinking of another option too, is a parent whose children don't believe is going to have their hands pretty full.
That's the other option, yeah.
And really needing to spend time at home, spend extra time with that child.
Yes.
And really doesn't have time to oversee other people.
Right.
If they're spending their time wisely.
Yeah, good point. And between those, what exactly Paul had in mind, I just frankly at this point don't know.
We'd have to do some more looking at
yeah.
it. Okay, I appreciate you saying when you know and when you don't know. I think sometimes we, out of our need to look smarter, that we say things that we don't really know.
Yeah, well, I think I do some of that, too.
You do some of that,
yes.
too? No. Wait a minute. Wasn't this all about we don't sin?
Yeah.
No, I think this is all about we do sin and do a lot of things we wish we hadn't have done.
Right.
And that's one. Okay. Jack, I was thinking about this. You said, let's get sophisticated. And I think I'd like to go back and kind of think about that and talk about that a little bit more.
Okay.
You were saying that we can't take any passage, or perhaps even in this case, any book, when we were talking about the First Timothy passage, out of context of the whole Bible.
Right.
If we do, we could make it say something different than it does. And so I have a little example that I think reflects the same thing in a different arena. And it's a little bit of my soapbox, so this is my opportunity to climb on top of it. In our society, especially in our Christian society or culture, the word counselor is kind of a dirty word for a whole lot of people. Counselor is seen as somebody who is really kind of, there's a lot of different perceptions people have, but generally speaking, I'd say in the Christian community, there's a negative shadow on that. And I would agree with a lot of people that counseling is not a helpful thing. In fact, in many ways, it can be a very hurtful thing. I have seen it be very hurtful in many people's lives. I have had, you know, lots of people who have been through counseling and come to see me, and they are washed up on shore by the events of their lives, but also by the counseling that they received. Now, when I go out into the Christian community and I say that I am a counselor, I have that perception of me already, an unfair context that I'm put into. I think it's really important when I talk that people understand me and see me and have talked to me and understand the place that I'm coming from. And so when they listen to my words, they are heard in the context of the other commitments of my life, of the understandings of my life, not just thrown into a preconceived understanding of what a counselor is. It makes a huge difference
right.
for people when they understand me and who I am and where I'm going, as opposed to just counseling generally. So I've had a really big road, I feel so often that I'm walking upstream. Even in the church that I'm in now, people come with a very different perception of counseling. And I think that happens likewise in the scripture. If we come to it with a particular understanding of what it means and aren't open to what exactly the author here is saying, we may be very misdirected and come up with very wrong conclusions.
Right, exactly. And it's not... Well, first, let me give a parallel example that probably everybody can relate to, and that is just the label Christian. You know, how many believers recognize when they go out into the world and tell their non-Christian neighbors and colleagues and something, I'm a Christian, and then realize, oh no, I'm not that kind of person. You know, I'm not that. That recognizing that there's all kinds of preconceptions that your neighbors and colleagues have of what it means to be a Christian that doesn't actually reflect who you are. That's the same phenomenon that you're talking about
exactly.
with counselor.
Yeah.
And that's exactly right. It's not that there's a label that triggers it when we come to 1 Timothy 3, but we do come with a whole set of preconceptions about what the Bible is going to tell me, what it is going to mean, what picture it's going to paint for me. And sure enough, its words are going to paint that picture for me because I've already decided it's going to paint that picture for me. And it takes a lot of work to allow the scripture to say to me, but not that picture that you have.
Mm-hmm.
You've come to some hasty conclusions. Relax a second, set your picture aside, and let me paint on a fresh canvas for you.
Just as it does if I'm a Christian, in your example, going into a workplace, a secular workplace, and saying I'm a Christian, but wait a minute, let me define what that means
exactly.
to you. And it would take, we can all imagine, a huge amount of effort on the part of the people, our coworkers, to even consider another perception of what that is, especially if for years and years they have had this idea of what a Christian is, and it's just firm in their minds. And a lot of people just can't let go of that, just won't let go of it.
Right.
And I think it's the same when we enter into Scripture. We just can't let go of what may be erroneous.
Exactly. And what makes it more difficult is we get to something like 1 Timothy 3, and Paul is not writing it with the desire to clear up my false picture. He doesn't even know that me in the 20th century has this false picture of what it is that he's portraying as Christianity. So he's not even aware that he needs to, so he doesn't write it in a way to clear that picture up. So I can be as open as I want to about letting the text speak, and that particular text is never going to clear up my picture because he's not setting out to do that. And that's why it's so important to open up the data that I use to not just that particular passage, but everything Paul had to say every word in the New Testament. That's why that becomes important, because only then can I allow him to paint on a fresh canvas with everything he has to say, and not just sort of isolated snippets.
It's really hard for us, isn't it, to allow God to paint on a fresh canvas.
Very hard, yeah.
It's very, very hard.
I have gone through some fairly significant shifts in my thinking a number of times throughout my 30-some years as a Bible teacher. And each time, it's really kind of emotionally traumatic to look back and go, boy, I've been wrong about that. I've gone public teaching that, and now I have to admit that it actually was erroneous. That's very difficult. And there's a lot of emotional comfort we get, a lot of emotional security we get in just wanting to know I'm right, you know, wanting to know that this is the truth,
that
this is the
settled.
Way that it is, that it's settled.
Yeah, and that I have solid ground to walk on.
Yeah.
I want things to be laid out. I want them to be black and white. I want to know where I'm going and just head in that direction.
I don't know if I've told this story before on the air, but I was once in a conversation with a colleague of mine, and he was bothered by what he considered to be some of my unorthodox beliefs, my unorthodox understanding of things. And so to pursue it, I asked him, let me just ask you a question. If you had a choice between being orthodox and being right, which would you choose? And we must have gone 5 minutes with him refusing to answer the question because in his mind there was no difference between being right and being orthodox. Orthodoxy was right, and being right was orthodox, so there would never have to be a choice. Finally, I said, well, just pretend. I mean, just play with me. Just a thought experiment here. Just assume, for the sake of argument, that there's a difference between the orthodox position and the position that's right and true. If you had a choice to make between them, which would you take? And he said, orthodox.
Wow.
And my jaw,
I didn't expect that answer.
My jaw dropped. I mean, I was really shocked. I mean, it sort of deflated my whole argument with him. Because
you lost.
I lost. Because I could not imagine someone making that choice. I think it was both revealing and very honest of him, because I think that's really probably true, that the emotional security that one gains, the psychological security that one gains from just being able to have the support of a whole group of people saying, you're right, yeah, you're on the right track, this is settled, you don't need to worry your pretty little head about it any longer, the emotional security that comes from that is very seductive and very attractive to us. But I think that we're supposed to be all about is seekers of truth, with all of the insecurity that implies, with all of the willingness to be steered and directed and guided down unfamiliar paths, down scary unfamiliar paths, because I just don't know where exactly it's going to end up. And that is frightening, and I've experienced that. I've experienced the terror of that, and I know that it's not at all comfortable, but I really don't see that the Bible gives us any other choice. This is about truth, not about comfort. This is about finding what our life is really all about and who God really is and who we really are in relationship to Him.
That is so very difficult because, you know, in a very real way, I know we've just said this, but we really do want to head toward comfort, Jack. There is so much that's uncomfortable in our lives that we're scrambling to kind of put things together. Life is really not very manageable. Life is very, very hard, and we want to make it as manageable as we can and at least give ourselves the illusion that some part of our lives have solid ground.
Right.
You know, I think that's very true, for example, in child rearing. People want to have particular formulas, particular rules, particular ways of disciplining, particular ways of talking or communicating with their children that just make it work, that guarantee that we have good children. And, you know, if I was to give a parenting class today, I think I might tell the parents is, you're just going to make a whole lot of mistakes, and I hope that you're willing to have a broken and contrite heart, to come back and say I was wrong and get up and try again, because these people that are in your care are not manageable. And I think we get ourselves into such huge predicaments by trying to make what is unmanageable too manageable. We end up controlling our children, and I think in the same way we end up controlling our knowledge so that we're not open to more around us. I certainly understand that. I get it. There's been this idea of the Y2K problem coming up, and as a possibility, that the year 2000 computer glitch. And I have really gone through a transition with that, thinking, I really don't want my world to be turned at all. I don't want there to be an inconvenience. I don't want people to not be able to get into their cars and drive to my place of work so that I can do counseling with them. You know, all the implications, I don't want to have to go to the grocery store and not have everything I want there. You know, we don't know what's going to happen with that. But certainly the questions that it raises, the possibilities of interruptions that it brings to mind is really talking about this same thing. I think I fight it because I don't want something to be out of my control. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do with the Bible. I just want to keep it the way it was so that I don't have to go through the incredible discomfort. Sometimes, Jack, don't even feel like I have time to go through the discomfort of it again.
Right.
There's so much to do all the time. There's so much that's pulling on my time that it would be so much easier just to leave it well enough alone, won't you?
Yeah.
Okay, so Jack, before we get off the air, there was one passage that you brought to mind that was really, really quite important, Ephesians 1:4.
Yeah, he talks about that we who are believers should be holy and blameless before him. We've talked about blameless in the context of Zacharias and Elizabeth, and I don't need to talk about that again, but there's the word holy. We have also talked about that in past programs, but maybe I should just briefly review. What he means, I think it's really becomes quite clear that what holy means in the New Testament is not good, not impeccably and flawlessly good, but rather distinctive and different, or what some people call set apart from the other people in the world. Now, how are we set apart? They're morally unworthy and I'm not morally unworthy? No, I don't think so. Not in the light of everything that Paul has to say about us. But rather, just like these qualifications for the elders and deacons that we looked at, we have embraced an entirely different value system from my neighbors and my colleagues, my non-Christian neighbors and colleagues. They can kind of brush integrity aside with a, you know, without a thought. I can't do that any longer. The importance of being an honest person whose word is trustworthy, who finds justice more important than my convenience and my comfort and my well-being, who finds it absolutely essential that I be a loving person to everybody around me, and we could go right on down the list. Those values are so important and so loom so large to me that I really stand out as a really freaky, weird, different sort of human being in this world. I just don't act and think like other people around me, because my values are so different. And what the Bible calls that person is holy. That person is set apart. That person has been marked with the brand of God's ownership, and he wears that brand on his own character, on his own heart. That's what he chose us for, that in this world we would be holy and blameless before him, that we'd be those kind of people and stand out in the crowd of humanity.
Okay, so by way of review today, what we were trying to get our arms around here was, if we are morally broken people, then how do we look at these passages that call us to be blameless, holy, righteous, above reproach, etc.? And if I can just real briefly say what I think you are telling us, is that it isn't that we are to be imperfectly, impeccably, flawlessly righteous, blameless, holy, above reproach, but that we have a commitment toward wanting to be people who are committed to and valuing what is good. We will make mistakes in the midst of it, but nonetheless, we want to do what is good and what is right. When we look at these passages, we need to look at them not just in context of the passages all by themselves, but we need to look at them in context of the whole scripture. That makes a huge difference as to how we will look at and interpret what is being said in any place in the Bible.
I'd like to tell you something about Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a great books college. And what does that mean? Well, one way to answer the question is to say that the focus of Gutenberg is reading and discussing books written by the greatest thinkers of Western civilization. Another way of answering the question is to describe what a typical day looks like for a Gutenberg student. The day begins by delving into the deep and elegant thought of the ancient Greek mathematicians. In front of his peers, and with their help, a student sorts through a carefully crafted proof penned over 2,000 years ago. Following, the students probe into the nature of written language and the study of classical Greek. It is here that he or she builds the tools for clear writing and skilled reading. Next, they learn of the rise of the Roman Empire. And throughout the week, students will hear lectures on Roman politics, art, religion, and philosophy. They will have the opportunity to ask questions during these lectures, gaining insight into the Roman state. They see how the Romans fit into the bigger picture of developing and declining cultures, which have brought us to where we are today. Then the day culminates with a discussion seminar on Virgil's Aeneid. Together, students seek to understand the story, sometimes exasperated and sometimes excited, but always engaged. After classes, informal discussions are carried on while others chat about the day's event. In the relaxed setting, a student spends a few moments getting to know an instructor. If you're interested in this kind of education, an education that focuses on growing in wisdom, listen at the end of the program for information on how you can contact Gutenberg College.
One of the things that happens in counseling is that the people I work with don't get to know a lot about me. They get to know some, but I get to know them inside and out, and they don't get to know me hardly at all. A way one of the people I work with has gotten around that is they started getting these tapes of the radio program. They love these tapes. What they come to me and say is, gosh, Christine, you're really showing us the nitty-gritty of your life. You're really showing us where you fail. You're really showing us that you're not all together like you appear to be in the office. And I think that lots of times we appear to be very together just because we don't know another person, because we haven't gotten under their skin, because we don't know what their lives are really like. That's one of the things that I'm trying to do in this program with Jack, is to share what our lives are really like. It's easier for me. I share examples much more freely, and actually that's why I'm here. For Jack, I have to push you a little bit, Jack. I'm always kind of saying,
hey, Jack. I'm not telling nobody nothing.
You're not telling nobody nothing. No. That's how I feel sometimes, Jack. Come on, Jack, tell us something. So I just feel like I'm pulling at you sometimes, but I don't think it's because you don't want to share. I think it's because that's not the way you think. He's nodding his head.
I am basically just shy. So I don't like to share, but I'm not against it in principle. I think you're right. It's an absolutely crucial and important thing, particularly for people who are in a position of teaching, that they be as transparent and honest as they can. And I'm all for that in principle. I just will resist you in practice.
Yeah, I've noticed. I notice that every single week when we record. But I think we've pulled some real stuff out of you, and I think that's really part of the heartbeat of this program. And for those of you out there who have written us and told us that, gosh, this has been really helpful, because it isn't just a presentation of super together people, but a presentation of real life. Thank you for your comments. And we really do covet you guys writing us. Please don't think the next guy's going to write or you'll write next week. But I'd really encourage you guys to sit down and write us a letter and tell us where we're meeting your life needs and where we are not. We'd also like to encourage you guys at the end of each of our programs now to consider contributing to this program financially if it has been of benefit to you. We need your contributions. We don't need a ton of money, but we do need contributions to continue to keep this program on the air.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.